Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for August the 6th, 2018. This is David Corey. My usual co-host Richard Hurley is on vacation tonight. In fact, if he's listening, hello, Richard. He's sailing on a cruise ship off the coast of Alaska. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us this evening. We have a very special guest, Beth Leeds. But before I introduce Beth, let me remind everyone that we are a call-in show, so feel free to call in anytime. I'll give you the toll-free call-in number in just a moment if you want to grab a pen and paper. If you have any questions for our special guest, Beth Leeds, or something on your mind related to what we're talking about, give us a call. Our toll-free call-in number covering the entire United States is 1-888-627-6008. Again, toll-free call-in number 1-888-627-6008. Our special guest has been an activist of one kind or another nearly her entire life. Beth Leeds grew up in Laguna Beach, California, a friendly town where she would later become an activist as a founding member of the Historical Society, the Free Clinic, and several environmental and peace groups. But first, let me tell you a bit about Beth's adventures as a youngster. In 1949, as the world was recovering from World War II, 8-year-old Beth and her mom traveled to Germany on the Queen Elizabeth ocean liner as part of the first military dependence in the Army of Occupation. In Germany, Beth lived in a small town near Frankfurt. Her father was a captain at R&R Camp King, which also was an Army intelligence camp. I expect she'll share with us tonight some of her experiences in post-World War II Germany. Those experiences set the stage for a life of activism in various environmental and peace causes. Beth is also the author of many books, including Beth Leeds' Activist Guide, Miss Leeds Goes to Washington, Lobbying Mendocino Style, and The Happening, the 1970 Laguna Beach Christmas Festival, as well as many other books. Her books are available on Amazon.com. So without further delay, let's welcome Beth Leeds to the Veterans News Hour. Good evening, Beth, and how are you?
Aloha. I'm doing great. It's very exciting to be part of your Veterans News Hour. I actually was an Army brat consultant.
Well, you're an honorary veteran in our eyes, Beth, and you know, our listening audience includes a lot of veterans, but also their families, and anyone who has been a family member, or as the military calls them, dependents, knows that it's really a family experience being in the service. So there's a lot we can discuss and that we will discuss tonight, but let's start with what it was like for you at the end of World War II when you went to Germany.
Well, it was really exciting. I was 8 years old and in Laguna Beach, and we traveled by train to New York, and then we got on the Queen Elizabeth, which was actually commandeered by the Army for the 3,000-plus Army dependents and the mothers and children of the Army personnel. So we were on the Queen Elizabeth, which is a giant, giant cruise ship, and actually it was New Year's Eve, and we were in the 100-year storm
wow.
in the Atlantic. The waves were crashing over the ship. The ship was actually with the first roll. We were all at lunch and at long tables, and everything went down over to the right side where it all crashed. From then on, we had to take our meals separately, and a lot of people were injured. And including my mother had a little problem. So I went to the doctor, and I realized that there was a huge line of all these women and children standing there waiting for the doctors to see them. So I devised a system where they would all take numbers, and then they could go sit in the lounge, and then I would run back and forth telling them your number is going to be called, and then they didn't have to stand in line for sometimes an hour while the ship was going back and forth.
Wow.
So they realized that I had some good ideas, and I did do other things as well. But then one time, you know how the Army has, like, drills where you have to do it at 0900 or whatever?
Yes.
And so we had a drill, and all the dependents and children were all supposed to be up on the deck. And there was, like, an inch worth of water on that deck, and it was rolling. And my mother was very, very worried that someone would go over, or that the waves which had previously crashed over that deck might do it again. So she told me to go up and down the deck and yell, "Everyone below, captain's orders." And so I did it. And actually, even the soldiers and everyone went below, and no one ever said a word about it. And so I realized that I actually gave a top-level Army commandment that day, and wow, probably saved some lives. So they were all really happy. And my mother made best friends with a general's wife, who was actually also stationed at Camp King in Frankfurt.
Wow. So you were stationed in a small town outside of Frankfurt, right, near Camp King. What was that like? And if you could describe for our viewers what life was like, what you saw, some of the things that you saw in Germany at that point.
Yeah. Well, at first we were stationed in what was called Little America in Frankfurt, where the Army had taken over a certain area, and it was for men who had wives and children, that's where they lived. And it was a beautiful apartment, and I remember going into this huge quartermaster's warehouse and picking out the furniture that we wanted and everything. It was very strange. My mother felt really bad because she realized, oh, this is all people's stuff. But anyway, so she didn't like living there because we had to walk around rubble. It hadn't been cleaned up yet, and so the streets were across the street from us in Frankfurt were bombed out buildings and things. So my mother wanted to live in the country, and no other Americans really, maybe just out of the 3,000, I don't know how many were there, just maybe a handful of Americans wanted to live out in the country. So my mother got general's quarters. So we
wow.
lived out in Oberursel in Taunus, which was a little ways from Frankfurt. And it was really exciting. We had a full-time 24-hour guard with a German Shepherd dog, and I made friends with them. And so I would do my homework because I went to school in Frankfurt in the general's office, actually, because he had a large office and a table where I could do my homework. So believe it or not, I was actually privy to all these top secret meetings that he held. And
wow.
One time they were trying to figure out an escape route, and they were looking at the map, and they were going, well, I think we should go here. And so I raised my hand. I said, can I interrupt? And they looked at me like, what? You've been listening? And I said, well, why don't you go this way? It's more direct and easier. And they said, well, there's no street there. And I said, well, I go on that all the time with my girlfriends. And so I took them there, and they saw it, and they were amazed. And so then every once in a while, they would ask my opinion. The reason that I knew about it was that in the 40s, 49 and 51, right after the war, the military could not wear civilian clothes, and even when they're off duty. So they actually had to wear Army clothes. So it was very difficult for the military to fraternize with local Germans. But me, I was, you know, made friends with everyone. I wore civilian clothes. I was invited into their homes. I knew, and I also wore German clothes, and my girlfriend and I would trade. Sometimes she'd wear my clothes and act like she was the American and I was the German. We played a lot. So I actually got to know the land, and I got to know a lot about Germans. So one time when General Eisenhower came, he was actually a five-star general of the Army back then, he came to Frankfurt. They sat me in the front row, and they told me when he walked by, he says, "Is this a little girl that you've been telling me about?" And the general, I was sitting next to the general, and he said, "Yes, this is Elizabeth." They called me Elizabeth then. And so Eisenhower actually took me aside and asked me a bunch of questions and asked me if I would continue consulting with them. I said, "Wow. Sure." So that was my big story about that. Man, I mean, I did a lot of other things too, but that was like the biggest.
What did you learn from that experience? Seeing, you mentioned earlier about places that you saw that were bombed out and Germany's recovering from the war. Did you learn some things then that contributed to your later dedication to working for peace and how to work for peace?
Actually, I did. Because the military called it, quote, the army of occupation, end quote. Now, I saw what they were doing. They were helping Germans rebuild. They were helping Germans do quite a lot of things that they were not capable of doing themselves because a lot of their warehouses and things had gotten bombed. So I realized at that early age that actually it wasn't the army of occupation. It was really the army of deoccupation. And so I learned that war, that there can be such a thing as deoccupation. And I believe that it starts with friendship. I believe that the Americans that went over there, of course, they had their women and children there. And so they were not being aggressive, they were being friendly. And I think that had quite a lot to do with my realization when I was working with the oil companies later, like 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and with, you know, huge land developers and everything, I realized that, you know, if you approach things in a different way rather than being opposed to things, if you just looked at their side and you said, you know, there's a point to their side, but maybe the point might change a little bit, and maybe they might, maybe nice things might be happening instead of bad things. And so that's been my approach to peace, because I believe that peace begins with friendship. It also begins with a ceasefire, and it begins with people wanting to help the other side. I remember one of the things that I learned back in the day was that when during battle, if you were wearing a Red Cross, like you were a doctor or something, even on either side, that they didn't shoot at you. And my grandfather was a doctor in World War I, and so he in France, and he told me that. And so I realized that, you know, things need to improve now, and I believe they can.
Yes, and I think those lessons that you've mentioned, the points you've emphasized, are so important that I think they're lessons that people need to hear about. Because when you think about it, within the space of you know, just a generation, we fought two world wars, including Germany, and yet after the war, as you described it, we gradually became allies again, became friends, and the peace is built around ultimately friendship, and I think what you've described really shows that well. Now, Beth, you've been involved in a lot of activism over the years, both environmental and peace movements. Can you tell us a bit about some of the highlights of those experiences?
Well, I guess, like, there's a few biggies, and probably the one that I think is really pretty incredible is that I actually wrote the National Ocean Protection Act in my kitchen. And I lobbied Congress three or four times, three or four different years, as a volunteer lobbyist, just getting, you know, $20 here, $50 there, whatever. And I went to Washington as a citizen, as a person, and met with about 25 or 30 senators and congressmen and the head of the Department of Interior and oil companies in those 4 days, because I always like to make the appointment in advance, and then I have my schedule. That's all I do is just go visiting. And so I convinced them. Well, one of the things that I did, which was really kind of fun, is I met with one of the congresswomen from Kansas, and I was trying to get the California Ocean Protection Act passed. And she came up to me and she said, "Well, you know, why should I vote for it? There's no ocean in Kansas. We don't have a Kansas coast." And I said, "You're right. You don't have one. So let me think about that." So I went back to, Mendocino, and the next year, within a couple months, I went back again, and I made a brochure. And the brochure had a picture of the Mendocino coast on it. And then the headline of the brochure was, "Save the Kansas Coast." And then underneath it, it said, "Well, actually, the coast you see is in Mendocino, but we believe it belongs to all Americans." And then inside, I said, "Save the Georgia Coast." Well, because I was actually lobbying the Appropriations Committee so that they would put a moratorium on offshore oil drilling, which they did. But then, all of a sudden, everybody agreed, and Congress passed the National Ocean Protection Act.
Wow. That's great. And I liked how you got people to feel that they had kind of a stake in it. That you're right. It is kind of the coast for all Americans, even though whether it's California or the Atlantic. Can you tell us more about what was happening out in California at that time that got you involved in that and to that particular piece of legislation? If you could tell us a bit more about what that did.
Yes. Well, the first meeting that I attended was on, I saw the notice in a little Mendocino newspaper on page 12, and it was only a couple of inches, and it said offshore oil meeting at Thursday at 2 o'clock or whatever. And so I attended the meeting, and actually I hadn't really done too much environmental activism up in Mendocino right at that time. I was kind of building my house and doing all this stuff. And so I went, and I realized that there was no one standing up. People were just kind of sitting there and listening to what they had to say. And then this fisherman stood up because they were talking about, well, you get, you know, $4 a pound for salmon, you know, if you lose your salmon in case of an oil spill and all this. And so this fisherman stood up and he said, "Well, what's the price of a seagull?" And then I saw a hearing team from the Department of Interior. I saw them all kind of look at each other. And I realized, you know, our coast is priceless. And then I realized our country is priceless. And we are priceless. And so if destruction is involved, then money is involved because people are doing it for money. So I'm going, hey, you know, instead of you doing something bad, you don't have to lose your job. You can still keep the same job, but just do something good. And, you know, I kind of convinced quite a few people. And we had a big movement then.
Wow. Well, I think that's a great point you just made about, you know, we hear so much about people saying, well, you'll put people out of work, they'll lose their jobs. But what you've just said, it just shows that with some positive thinking that people don't have to lose their jobs, they just do something different. Beth, I know you've written...
That reminds me of something that I forgot to say. I was reading on the internet a couple months ago, And I'm always looking for something, for good news. In fact, I did have a radio show called The Good News. It was really fun. But and I saw that China actually ordered 60,000 of their soldiers who had been, you know, cleaning their guns and doing all the things that soldiers do, but they had ordered them to plant trees instead. Which comes down to, you know, all you have to do is give the military an order, and they'll do it. And I thought that was pretty good, because I think our military should do that, should do something like that. Because, you know, we do have, like, for example, in Hawaii, Hawaii is really a very special place, and they just had war games in Hawaii. I don't know if you know about that, but 25 nations and 25,000 soldiers went to Hawaii.
Wow.
And it kind of raised havoc. I mean, they were actually what a lot of people called it. They had, at the beginning, they had kind of like a symposium where people, different people showed their weapons and all this. People could order weapons. It was kind of like a trade show for weapons. And then after that, they used all the weapons for 2 months, and they were bombing, and they were using sonar in the ocean and everything. And so it was really, really, really not that nice. And I was thinking it would really be nice for, you know, the commander of the Pacific region in Honolulu to do something nice now for Hawaii. Because, you know, we are, Hawaii is under national disaster with the hurricane and also the flooding on Kauai.
Right.
And the volcano is still happening, and it's really a disaster there. So I'm thinking, you know, military, I would encourage like maybe 5% of the military, I don't know, to do something good for people. Because part of the, I was looking at the RIMPAC, which is the name of the Pacific Rim war games thing. That's what they called
right.
it. And I was reading their literature, and it does say that they're supposed to help in a disaster. It did say that. I have the paragraph. And so I'm going, well, we didn't do it.
Yeah, it sounds like what the National Guards typically do whenever there's, like in Florida, a hurricane or tornadoes or the volcanoes. And just kind of digress a bit, Beth. You I know you're in California now, but you lived in Hawaii previously. Did you not? And what can you tell us what things were like there? You mentioned the volcanoes a few minutes ago. How are things there?
Hawaii is to me the Hawaiian Islands are the Hawaiian Kingdom, because now the United Nations is recognizing the Hawaiian Kingdom. And there's all kinds of buzz about that, because they were never annexed legally. And then also in 1959, when Hawaii became a state, a lot of people didn't really know about it, and it was kind of bamboozled. And so now there's it's still actually an ongoing Hawaiian kingdom from, I guess, the 1700s or 1800s or whatever. And, of course, before that, they were, you know, Hawaiians living there for thousands of years. So I'm really active in that, because I see it as a wonderful thing. And the United Nations is also working towards that goal. And so I'm talking about the United Nations, and right now what I'm doing, I'm really excited about it, because I did call the United Nations last week. And since then, I've gotten 3 calls from different people in the Peace Department of the United Nations, because now what I'm doing is I'm doing postcards of peace. And in Ojai, Ojai is an international city of peace. There's actually 220 cities of peace right now around the world. Any city could be a city of peace. In fact, I think all cities should be a city of peace, and I think that would really be great. But what we're doing is the city of Ojai is buying 1,000 postcards, and on August 19th, which is a Sunday, we're going to be writing down all those postcards with a peace plan. And part of the peace plan, of course, will be friendship. It will be ceasefire. It'll be whatever anybody wants to write because it's of the people. The people can say whatever they want. So I encourage your listeners to do the same. If they want to write postcards, we can give them an address, you know, and they can contact you later for that.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, that's a great idea. So that's part of your peace plan forum that I understand that you're starting. And the idea is to expand that, schools, churches, other organizations, and to get people involved. And tell us more about kind of your vision for what these cards where people would fill out what their ideas for peace would be, whether it's, you know, friendship with other countries, starting with the ceasefire. And what do you envision doing with those cards and going from that point?
Well, I believe encouraging those decision makers. And, you know, part of the decision makers are the UN, but also at the General Assembly, that you have hundreds of countries. And so I would really like to go to these to the General Assembly. This would be my dream come true. I would like to go give each of the countries a little envelope. And inside that envelope, well, because I've done this before in workshops and everybody loves it, so I thought, well, I could do a workshop for them. It wouldn't be called a workshop, of course. And inside these envelopes, I would hand paint on hard paper an olive branch, and I'd kind of cut it out. So, and then that would be number one thing in the envelope. Number two thing in the envelope would be a little certificate of appreciation with the name of their country written in gold. And I probably passed out about 10 or 20,000 certificates of appreciation because I loved it. I was carrying with me and everything. I loved handing them out. And I always say, what's your name and how do you spell it? And then I write their name in gold. I do that to the secretaries when I'm lobbying in Congress. I do it to the taxi drivers. They always give me free rides, and I look up and they have my certificate pinned up on their headliner.
So, wow.
And the number three thing would be like maybe a popsicle stick or some kind of a little stick. And on that stick is a little piece of white cloth. And I would ask them to take out that little stick and hold it up. And to me, truce, that little white flag, the little white piece of cloth, we all know what that means. And it's a universal thing, just like the word aloha. It's universal. Everyone knows what it means. And it's like just giving them that idea that, you know, just for that second, you can hold up just a little piece of white fabric, and it means something to the whole world. It means ceasefire. And ceasefire can end up meaning peace. Yay!
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good starting point because I've been thinking a lot about that since you first told me about that idea, that just how simple it sounds, but that's kind of the genius behind it, which is the idea of a ceasefire. You know, every war that's been fought, it's always come to an end at some point. So the idea is let's just move that end of the war up a lot sooner and start with the ceasefire. Now, there have been people around the world that have started, and the UN and other organizations have recognized, like, a day of peace. It's a good starting point.
Right, but a day of peace isn't a ceasefire.
I'm sorry?
A day of peace is not a ceasefire. A ceasefire is everybody in the military, everybody holding a gun knows what ceasefire means.
Right, right. I was just thinking in terms of it's a good start in that direction whenever you encourage those at war to have a ceasefire, that it's a starting point towards a longer term peace, which is the objective, at least one of the objectives.
Yes. Yes.
So, Beth, I know you've written quite a few books. I mentioned them in an introduction. They included Beth Leeds' Activist Guide, Miss Leeds Goes to Washington, Lobbying Mendocino Style, and The Happening, the 1970 Laguna Beach Christmas Festival, and others. Would you mind telling us a bit about each one of those books?
I would love to. Well, The Happening, the book The Happening, in 1970... in Laguna Beach, a friend of mine who was a hippie, and he envisioned having some kind of a Christmas festival somewhere in Laguna Beach, and I thought that would be great. And so he was kind of a little out there, and I just thought every one of his visionary papers that he wrote was really incredible. So I kind of got into it. And then a couple other people did, and a poster was written and drawn. And it was a beautiful poster, and it said a picture of Jesus on it, a gorgeous, beautiful, beautifully drawn, and a little down below with the little coastline of Laguna Beach, and it said, "Come to Laguna Beach, come to the Christmas festival," and et cetera. And then on a little part of it, kind of an obscure part, it said 144,000, and then it said REV period 7 period 4. And I didn't really think about it because there was a whole bunch of other writing on it and everything. So getting close to when the Christmas festival was happening, I had protected this one area and saved this one area in the canyon because I love saving beautiful land, and so I saved a lot of land. Thousands and thousands of acres, but the way I save it usually is I get the owner of the land to dedicate it or to save it. But anyway, so I got this area out in the canyon to do this festival, and actually 25,000 people showed up. And the city of Laguna Beach was really upset about it, and they closed the street down, and so people just parked along the road or they walked in. So thousands and thousands of people walked in for 3 days. It was a three-day festival. It started the day before, and then, of course, a few days before that, we set it up, and I had a restaurant in town, a vegetarian restaurant, and actually Pepperidge Farm. I went there, and they had left 200 loaves of thinly sliced bread. And I was able to take that bread that night and put, like, goulash on it, you know, vegetable stew-like. And we carried that. People carried that. And then other people carried big trays with the bread. And I put it on. And we served 6,000 people with those 200 loaves of bread. Because it was 30 slices on each bread, on each loaf. So on Christmas Day, day after Christmas, I mean, the LA Times was on the stage, and I looked at it, and it said Laguna Sealed, S-E-A-L-E-D. And I thought, wow, that's unusual. And then there was a Bible right there, and I looked at the poster, and I go, wonder what that Revelation 7:4 says. And so I did. I looked it up right then, and it said, and then they were sealed, the 144,000 children of God.
Ah.
I mean, you could look at it. Anybody can look at it and see it. So I just went, wow, that was cool. And then right after that, at 6 o'clock in the morning, they had it was called the Iron Rings, first time the police ever did it. And because we were kind of in a little valley in this little tiny canyon. And I saw 6 o'clock, they said it's a illegal assembly. The helicopter said. And so just then on the top of the ridge, I saw maybe 50 or 75 soldiers, not police, but they were wearing bayonets and black, you know, guards, the black guards and black clothes and everything. It was scary. And then in about 1 minute, then they started walking down 20 feet. And then there was another row, and then they started walking down in another row, and actually there were 400 of them, And there's probably about 200 or 300 of us. We were cleaning up because the city said we could clean up and give all the pots and pans. We're all stacked and washed for the churches and everything, and they've donated them. So we have no idea this was happening. But I did see one person standing there in a baseball, with a baseball cap and a tan baseball jacket in the very middle of these guys. So I asked my girlfriend, well, come with me, okay? And so we walked up through all these police with bayonets and everything, and they just stood very still. And we walked right up to the guy, and I said, you know, I assume you're in charge, but we're just supposed to be cleaning up. And he said, well, you know, it's gone beyond that. We can't do anything about it. And so I said, well, can we have 5 minutes, and I can tell everybody, we can get everybody out? And he said, yes. But then when I walked down, then they started advancing and macing people and stuff. And so then the kids were like picking. I was the oldest person there. I think they were pretty much teenagers and stuff helping. And so they came down. So my Army days came back again. And as an Army brat, I took control. And I said to everyone really loud, I said, everyone, put your hands on your head. And so we all put our hands on our heads, because I remember that's what they did in Germany. Before the war, when they were military, when we had captured Germans and stuff, then they had to put their hands on their head, and then we didn't shoot them. And so that worked. And so they rushed us out to the edge of the canyon, and there were school buses there. And I got on one of the school buses. And see, I grew up in Laguna. And I got on one of the school buses. It was a school bus driver. He goes, Beth, what are you doing there? And I said, well, I was in charge. And he goes, well, let's get to town. And then he drove. And I knew the school bus driver that was driving us all out. Anyway, that was pretty exciting. That was the happening book. And then the other book was Miss Leeds Goes to Washington. And that was really fun. That was all about one of my lobbying things. Actually, I have two more that are in the works right now. And that was all about lobbying. And ordinary people can do extraordinary things. And so I went to Washington. We got the money through a radio show, kind of like yours. We called it an oil-a-thon. And for an hour, we raised about $2,000, and we managed to, my girlfriend and I went. She accompanied me, and I was actually invited by Representative Don Clausen, who was the Republican whip. So see, Republicans, Democrats, independents, oil companies, Monsanto, I don't care who they are. They are my friends.
Ah.
Because they're the decision makers, right?
Right.
They're the ones I have to influence. So anyway, it worked out. So that, and then the third one was you get last wish. And this is about a lady, Yvette Clark. And her father was the richest. Him and Rockefeller in the 20s were like the richest people in the world. And she had lived in a mansion that cost more money than Wrigley Field or whatever. I mean, they were super, super, super rich. But she actually died in a nursing home when she was 104. And it was like a nursing home. People hadn't seen her for 20 years. It was like a little nursing home, and she loved her doll. So I had visited a place earlier that was a nursing home in California. So I thought, you know, my girlfriend told me about her dying, and I Googled her. I got up in the morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I typed it on my phone until 5 o'clock I wrote that book. And it's kind of my helping her. She never had fun, because everybody was all interested in her money, and nobody, you know, just wanted to be friends. So we ended up being friends, and it all took place at her Santa Barbara mansion called Bell's Guardo, B-E-L-S-G-U-A-R-D-O, and it's still there, and it's right on the ocean. But we played around, because I learned a little bit about her, and we really had a lot of fun in this book, and I kind of feel like, you know, it kind of really happened to me in a way, because I had no idea I was going to write that book. So that was the four books that I wrote. Oh, no, then I wrote the activist book. I wrote Bentley's Activist Guide And that is really cool because it tells people kind of, you know, give people my interpretation of how you can, you know, as an individual, make a big, huge difference, like who to talk to, the secretaries, make friends with them, talk about, you know, whatever is current with them. One Thanksgiving, we talked about how to bake a turkey, and I'm a vegetarian, but we talked about how to bake a turkey, and she ended up putting me right in touch with the person that I wanted to talk to. Also, with the United Nations, way back, I think it was in the 90s, Perez de Cuellar was the head of the United Nations, and it was right during, I think it was that Iraqi storm, firestorm or whatever, it was really almost the beginning of the war, and he was trying to see if he could bring peace. I called the United Nations, just a line I got Googling it, at 3 o'clock in the morning, their time. And a man answered, and I told him what I wanted, and he goes, well, I'm not supposed to be doing this, but. And then he gave me Perez de Cuellar's secretary's number. So I called her, talked with her, and they asked, who are you with? And I just said, Grandmothers for Peace. I just had to make up the name. And she said, oh, he's coming in right now, and he's crying, she told me. And I said, well, put him on. And so she handed the phone to him, and I said, you know, as long as there's an inkling of peace, of hope, an inkling of hope, there can be peace. And right. So he said, oh, thank you. No one's saying anything nice to me. They're all being very mean. And so then a little later we were watching on TV, and they interviewed him, and he said, as long as there's an inkling of hope, there's a chance for peace.
Wow. Wow. Well, I think you've really shown the difference that one person can make. And one thing I really admire that you talk about in both your books, Miss Leeds Goes to Washington, and also your activist guides, something you mentioned earlier in our conversation, which is your certificates of appreciation that you would then fill out in gold ink. And there's so much just of a positive vibe, a positive approach to what you've done, which I think is such a big contrast to what's going on in America today, where there's just so much kind of in-your-face anger and frustration, and yet that's not to say that, you know, the issues then were just as contentious, but you took from, in my humble opinion, you took the high road, and I noticed in your book, The Activist Guide, and maybe you can tell us more about it, which was... you had a very effective method of crashing events. Now, crashing may sound to some people like kind of have a negative connotation, but the way you employed it was actually quite positive. I mean, you know, as far as it was a direct way, though, where you could meet the people, the decision makers. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you really quickly and short about two different things because my daughter's here with me and my friend, and I wanted them to know, too. We went to a big, huge meeting in Santa Monica one time, and there were 800 or 1,000 people there, and talk about crashing. And I think it was a Coastal Commission meeting or something, but the Department of Interior was there. And it was a huge meeting, and there were all kinds of movie stars there and everything. Walter Matthau was there, just different people. But anyway, I wanted to speak, and I usually can. I wanted to speak, and they wouldn't let me speak because they said, well, you're not a president of an organization or whatever. And so I'm sitting there wanting to speak because most of the groups, the Deer Club and all these different groups, they were all kind of selling out and stuff. And they weren't really protecting. It was about the sea otters. And what it was talking about relocating the sea otters, and you can't relocate them because then they'll just swim back to where they were, but they'll die in the way or whatever. And so it was getting close to the very end, and this one man was walking up. I go, I have to talk. And so I tore out this little piece of paper about 2 inches by 2 inches, and I wrote on the piece of paper, let the women and children speak. and then I folded it up really tiny. And when he was walking by down the aisle, I jumped up and I handed it to him. And I said, look at it. And so as he was walking down the aisle, he opened it up. He was walking down to the microphone, and he opened it up and read it. Everybody was wondering what it said, right? And so he put it in his pocket, and the hearing team, the chairman of the hearing team said, what did the note say? And then when he got it out and read what the note said, my daughter and I jumped up and were already in the aisle when he read, let the women and children speak. And we were already going. And so the hearing guy said, okay, you can talk. So that was one. We were the only two people that didn't want the otters to be relocated. And, of course, it was a disaster. It was a different record. But then, but nevertheless, we win or lose, we always try and do the right thing. And then we always get to talk. It always works out. Then right. I was on World Alert one time. This was Greenpeace was on TV. They were on MTV, and all these big, huge people came to Laguna. And I was president of Save Our Shores, and I was doing all this stuff and going to Washington and stuff. And they were all going, "Wow, we want to interview you on TV for this MTV show." And so I'm being prepped and almost going on the air, and in walks the mayor of Laguna, who is actually a sellout. But anyway, in he walks, and he stands in front of me, and he goes, I'm the one that could be interviewed. I'm the mayor of Laguna. And the girl that was doing the whole thing said, well, I'm sorry, you don't qualify, because this is about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And then they played it for 3 years, just in sight. Every week.
Wow. I saw, Beth, I saw in one of your in your book about the activist guide, where you tell the story too about how you were able to crash and talk directly to the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, and just how some of your approaches to do that, which I was struck with how positive it was. It was such a positive and yet effective way that, again, I contrasted with just the way so many people today deal with differences in our society and our culture. So that's why I think it's important that you share, you know, your views on kind of a positive but effective activist. Could you share more with us about that?
Well, that same mayor called me up and said, we're doing a protest in front of the hotel in Anaheim, some hotel. And he said, will you be there? Because they wanted me to stand out there and with signs and yell at the people coming in, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I said, oh, I'll be there. So I quickly got into my most beautiful dress that I got at a thrift store, like it was just fabulous. And I drove in my little Volkswagen that I had, and I drove up to this hotel, and I honked and waved at them as I drove to the entrance of the hotel. And waved at them, hi! And then I drove to the entrance, and the guy opens my door, and I had a balcony to park my car. And I walked into the hotel, and I said, oh, can you tell me which way I think it was Cecil Andrus. Can you tell me which way Cecil Andrus luncheon is? And they said, oh, it's down there, because I was dressed really nicely. I looked like I belonged. And so I went down and I looked, nope, there was a guard at the door. I go, oh, well, I go into the women's room and I start talking to the women that are in there. They're all at that I think it was $1,000 a plate lunch. And so I talked to them about Disneyland and everything, and then when they all walked out, I walked out with them. And then when I walked past the guard, we were all laughing and talking. Well, I got in, right? So I got in, but I didn't have a name tag, so I had a glass of wine. I held it over my shoulder, like where the name tag should be. But I walked right up because it was a meet and greet, and there was a man standing next to Cecil Andrus, and he said, oh, what's your name? You know, and then he would introduce me. And then I would act like a friend, and then we'd get my picture. So I go, my name is Beth Lee. So I go, and when I see Cecil Andrews, I say, well, you know, I'm really excited to be here, but I did want to let you know that I'm crashing. I wasn't actually invited, but I wanted you also to know that I do have a lawsuit against you, but I wanted to talk to you about it because I think that we can work things out. And he actually went over and we sat on a bench and talked about 5 minutes. And right after that, maybe 3 weeks after that, the resale, I think it was like, I don't know, 92, whatever it was, number, was canceled.
Wow.
And my lawsuit was dropped. So I think that, you know, people will do some little good things once in a while. And you just have to be honest about it. And, you know, do the best you can.
That's very impressive. And Beth, before we run out of time tonight, I just wanted to ask you if there's any other ideas, advice you have for people that they can do to further the cause of peace in the world.
Yes. Number one would be, I don't know if you have a website that people can go to. I don't really have a website, I have a Facebook page, but I would love to make up some certificates of appreciation that people could copy and, you know, print for themselves and write whatever they want to on them for themselves and give them away, because it's really, nobody gets anything. People don't give people things anymore. And I think it's really a nice gift. And then the second thing would be maybe write a postcard and they can find out the address, maybe from your site or maybe from, you know, me or something, to mail to the United Nations, or maybe they can get together maybe 10 or 20 cards and put them in an envelope and so it doesn't cost so much money for them. Because I'm wanting thousands. I want this to be a huge momentous. I want to create the momentum that individual people like you and me, and like the people who are listening, maybe there's only one of them. Maybe there's three or four sitting around listening to you. But anybody can do it. And together, we can make a difference. But individually, we can too. And that's why I do it individually, but when I go to Washington, I'm representing thousands of people that can't go.
Right, right. I think that's great. As far as a website, one that I can offer if people want to use and go to the Contact Us link on it, it's an easy website to remember. It's stopwar.today, stopwar.today, and go to the Contact Us link on that page, and you can have a couple addresses where you could send us these, and then I can forward these on to Beth. And, of course, we have our show website, which is bbsradio.com/the Veterans News Hour. I think those are all great things. And like you said, Beth, one person can make a difference, and working together we can have an even bigger impact. I was reading something else. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Stopwar.today.org or anything, or is it just stopwar.today?
No, it's just stopwar.today.
Yeah.
It's kind of a unique website, but
I love it.
Yeah, it's I started it, by the way. I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I started it. But whenever I was picking a website name, I thought, well, should I do like a .org or a .com? But then one of the choices was .today, and I thought, well, that fits in very, very nicely with the whole theme, which is, you know, kind of a sense of urgency. Let's work on this today. So,
I think,
it. Yeah,
it's
so
like
stop,
being here now. I love it. I'm proud of you for thinking of that. Brilliant.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And, Beth, we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on our show, and we appreciate very much you taking the time to share your experience with us and your thoughts, and we hope you'll join us again sometime in the future to keep us updated on all your projects. So thanks so much, Beth.
Aloha.
Yes, thank you, and good evening. Well, folks, it's been a very quick and fascinating hour. I'd like to thank you for listening. Our guest next week will be Lauren Price, talking about an important issue of the open-air burn pits, environmental contamination in Iraq and Afghanistan that's injured so many of our veterans. But that's our time for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'd like to thank our special guest, Beth Leeds, and our show producer, Mr. Doug Newsom at BBS Radio. Please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.